salt is for the life of the world. And allow me today to work with a modern day parable and this metaphor that Jesus brings to our attention. So first, a parable. There was once a town high in the Alps that straddled the bank of a beautiful stream. The stream was fed by springs that were old as the earth and deep as the sea. The water was clear like crystal. Children laughed and played beside it. Swans and geese swam in it. You could see rocks and sand and rainbow trout that swarmed at the bottom of the stream. And high in the hills, far beyond anyone's sight, lived an old woman who served as the keeper of the springs. She had been hired so long ago that no one could remember a time that she wasn't there. She would travel from one spring to another in the hills, removing branches or fallen leaves or debris that might pollute the water. But her work was unseen. One year, the town council decided they had better things to do with their money. No one supervised the old woman anyway. They had roads to repair, taxes to collect, services to offer, and giving money to an unseen stream cleaner had become a luxury that no one could afford. So the old woman left her post high in the mountains. The springs were untended. Twigs and branches muddied the liquid flow. Mud and silt compacted the creek bed. Farm wastes turned parts of the stream into stagnant bogs. For a time, no one in the village noticed. But after a while, the water was not the same. It began to look brackish. The swans flew away to live elsewhere. The water no longer had that crisp scent that drew children to play in it. Some people of the town began to grow ill. All noticed the loss of sparkling beauty that used to flow between the banks of the stream that fed the town. The life of the village depended on the stream, and the life of the stream on the keeper of the stream. And Jesus said to his disciples, "You are the salt of the earth," a parable and a metaphor. And like the keeper of the stream that flowed in the Alpine town, salt is a seasoning that draws little attention to itself. But its absence is noticed indeed. "Ugh, please pass the salt," or not to mention its potency. "Gasp, how much salt did you put in here?" But salt, when used well, is a seasoning that exists not to be tasted itself, but to enhance the surrounding flavor for everyone's enjoyment. What a beautiful metaphor of Christ's qualities intermingled with our society for its health and well-being. Qualities of humility, poverty of spirit, gentleness, longing, kindness, mercy. Somehow mysteriously, these qualities keep the stream of life flowing and salt the earth. My friends, following Christ is not so much a privilege as it is a responsibility. You are the salt of the earth. But it is an intricate task, isn't it? Too much and we destroy. Too little and it's bland. And Christians, historically, don't we know it, have struggled to attend to the intricacy of this task. There were centuries of destructive potency, oversalting, if you like. Those first few centuries when we disrespected our Jewish and Muslim neighbors who share much of our scriptures, we sacrificed relationship for being right. When robust living faith does not feel threatened by dissolution in the face of multiple possibilities. And then we got caught up in the arrogance of Christendom, colonizing the world in the name of Christ. We misrepresented Jesus, who had modeled self-emptying, and we provided answers without taking the time to listen. Times of oversalting. And then there have been bland times, times when salt has lost its saltiness. We have accommodated and lost our Christian identity. Tolerance can move pluralism into relativism. We performed acts of justice with no mention of Christ, for whom this is central. Or we promoted Christ with no compassion and action to assist the ones to whom we spoke. And we spoke of heaven as a distant reality and ignored and even violated the earth. Salt lost its savor. You are the salt of the earth, said Jesus. But friends, I confess, I am at a loss. I don't know how to attend to this intricate task of finding a delicate balance, sprinkling just enough into my conversations, my meetings, my friendships. Being salt is a relational task. It is not an over-assuming monologue, not a withdrawing, but it is this intricate interconnection. So I invite a new friend into my home, and we enjoy a meal, and we break bread together. And she looks over at my bookshelf. She comments on the books. And I say, I am a Christian. I say it with much intrepidation and a good deal of embarrassment, and immediately I feel the need to qualify. But I'm not like that, and I'm not like this, for I know that I have 2,000 plus years of history to contend with. One blogger that I follow wrote this: when I say I am a Christian, I am not a Christian who demands that others believe what I believe, or as I live, or as I profess. I am not a Christian who believes that God blesses North America more than God so loves the world. I am not a Christian who uses the Bible to perpetuate individual or systemic bigotry, racism, or sexism. I am not a Christian who is reluctant to call out the words of hateful preachers, of venomous politicians, of mean-spirited pew-sitters in the name of keeping Christian unity. I am not a Christian who tolerates a global church where all people are not openly welcomed, fully celebrated, and cared for. I am a Christian who wants to live as an image bearer of God, seeing God in people of every color, of every sexual orientation. I want to live a life with the characters of Jesus: humility and compassion, smallness, gentleness with people's wounds, attention to the poor and the forgotten and the marginalized, an intolerance for religious hypocrisy, and a clear expression of God's love. We are the salt of the earth. It is an intricate relational task. But why? Why do we do this? What motivates us? Surely it's not to fill our churches or meet our budgets or return to the heyday of Christendom. No, friends. In this emerging church era, we will be a small group of people where the church is not the goal, but the instrument. We are the salt of the earth, committed to the person of Jesus Christ. For I believe in the mystery that the world is saved by those it persecutes. And when I am in the presence of someone with Christ-like qualities, my heart sings, my life stream flows again. What a wonder when we recognize this in others. Alice, will you come and share with us your experience of Christ in someone special to you?
There are times, I think, when any one of us might wish for the faith to move a mountain right this second. But most of the time, what faith requires is the ability to put one foot in front of the other for long stretches of time. There's an old hymn that I think of when I reflect on the life of my mother. I know not where the road will lead I follow day by day, or where it ends. I only know I walk the King's highway. I know not if the way is long, and no one else can say, but rough or smooth, uphill or down, I walk the King's highway. My mother was born on the vernal equinox of 1911, almost reached her 98th birthday. She was a strong, practical woman who lived through tough times, as did many, as do many in any era. There's a family story that she would tell from time to time, how as a young child, her parents brought her to the door of a church, St. Nicholas Episcopal, located on the border between Brooklyn and Queens in the New York metropolitan area. Her parents pointed out the door and instructed her to go inside. And she went, apparently alone, which I consider to be her first great act of faith and trust. Did her parents really send her off to church alone? Maybe it was the door to a Sunday school room. We don't really know. Mom never offered details on any story. But the one thing I'm sure of is that her reliance on faith began on the other side of that door. The road ahead would be, at times, very hard. End of the First World War. Her two-year-old brother died in the influenza epidemic. How does any child have the faith after that to not be concerned that the same would happen to her? 1929, her mother died just months before the market crash that began the Great Depression. What does it take for an 18-year-old to find work while her father remains unemployed, to keep house, to take care of her 10-year-old sister, to set aside the thought she had had of studying to be a nurse. World War II, my parents lose their first child, stillborn, a girl, Christine. What courage does it take for a woman to try again? 1949, child number two, my brother, 4 years old, contracts polio during an epidemic summer. He's hospitalized more than 100 miles away from our home. It's a very long trip, or it was at that time, out onto Long Island by car. Mom's the only driver. Dad never did learn to drive. She's pregnant with number three, me. Faithfully, she visits him weekly, bringing him home in time for my birth the following year. She undertakes his physical therapy and rehabilitation, and I bet none of you would know that he'd ever had polio. 1958, her father suffers a stroke, which leaves him paralyzed on his left side. The doctors give him 2 years. She cared for him in our home for the next 8 years. Mom is drawing on things now learned when she was young, a very great blessing from her grandmothers, one who had been a midwife, the other a practical nurse. And by now, she's starting to see that she has herself become the nurse that she always wished to be. The way is truth, the way is love. For light and strength I pray. By 1975, her husband, my father, is now clearly suffering dementia. They can't afford a care facility. So another 6 years of in-home care, but thankfully this time with some outside assistance, although Mom continued to bear most of the weight of his care. It all sounds like too much to bear, but there's that thing about faith, the kind that puts one foot in front of the other, perhaps to move a mountain, one shovel full at a time. And Mom did more than just persevere. Mom loved greatly, and that love enabled all that she'd been called to do. Through light and dark, the road leads on till dawns the endless day, when I shall know why in this life I walk the King's highway. Starting in her late 80s, Mom had small strokes of her own that gradually brought on dementia. She had long since instructed my brother and me not to care for her at home, and thankfully we could place her in a care facility near enough my brother for him to visit frequently, me as often as work and airfare would allow. Good days, bad days. But for the most part, she remained cheerful and content. I actually think she was quite happy to sit outside the nurse's station and watch someone else do all that work. Our friend, the Reverend Rhonda Rubinson, would take communion to her on a monthly basis, always noting the peace that the service gave her. Though near the end, Rhonda also noted that Mom had latched onto something a bit unusual in a lifelong Episcopalian, something that seemed to punctuate the services. It seems that of the other church groups that visited on a regular basis to conduct services, the Baptists had quite an impact on Mom's last days. By then, she couldn't speak much, but she learned one last word and gesture of faith to see her through her last door. We had a bit of chuckle about it at the time, but ultimately it became our prayer as well, that we with her, as in this life, might in the next life together say, in Baptist style, Hallelujah!